Today on Vox Talks Economics, powerful forces have been reshaping global trade. So is this trend going to continue? And what does it mean? Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Center for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics, so remember, subscribe, follow us on Instagram as well. Well, firms in many economies are re-evaluating their approach to globalization, and you can understand why. We've had a pandemic, a trade war, cybersecurity threats, a climate crisis, and now a conflict in Ukraine that's maybe going to last for many years. It's all shown that global value chains, on which a lot of these firms rely, are not as resilient as perhaps we assumed. So I'm at the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development's new headquarters that they've just moved into, and very nice it is as well, to meet Chief Economist Beata Jaworczyk. Beata, welcome back to Vox Talks Economics.
Hi, Tim.
And I love your new building. You can see a large part of the global economy out of your window here.
Absolutely. The view is gorgeous.
But we've got to talk about the war on Ukraine. What impact has this had on international trade already, beyond the obvious effect, which is on the gas and oil trade?
Well, the war has already had a very visible impact on the regional trade patterns. The data show a very substantial drop in exports to Russia from the European Union. Mm-hmm. At the same time, we see a big increase in the EU exports to the Caucasus countries and to Central Asia. And in turn, the Caucasus and Central Asian countries are seeing a spectacular increase in their exports to Russia. So, for instance, exports from Kyrgyzstan to Russia tripled, while those from Armenia and Georgia more than doubled. So, in other words, trade between Western democracies and Russia is being intermediated by Central Asia and the Caucasus.
Can they do this? Is there sanctions busting?
Well, if you dig deep into the data, you see that indeed there is an increase in exports of sanctioned product categories. But of course, sanctions do not map neatly into a trade classification. But there are many other factors that can be driving this intermediated trade. Western firms may not want to be seen as exporting directly to Russia. They may have difficulties with clearing payments, or they may not want to bear the high compliance cost. So it may be actually useful for them to use intermediation.
So what about other countries then? How are their exports to Russia going?
Well, we see that both Turkey and China increased their exports to Russia, but it seems that they are exporting their own production. And in the case of Turkey, weakening of the national currency was certainly a stimulus that boosted competitiveness of the exports.
Now, the first time when we discussed the turmoil in global value chains that's going on at the moment in a Vox talk was a little while ago. We covered the broken World Trade Organization dispute resolution process, and that was during the US-China trade war. Seemed like innocent times now, almost. Has this dispute process been repaired yet?
Unfortunately not. Oh. The appellate body is still not functioning. And the tariffs on China that were introduced by the Trump administrations are still in effect.
And also on top of that, COVID-19, that exposed other fragilities in global value chains, didn't it? Ways that perhaps many of us hadn't considered. How have firms responded to that?
Back then, during COVID times, we talked a lot about the need to boost resilience, but we actually haven't seen much action on the part of firms. Mm-hmm. I think many firms viewed the disruption as a temporary phenomenon, and they simply decided to weather the storm rather than to incur the cost of making adjustment. After all, global supply chains have been optimized for the lowest cost. So any adjustment would result in higher prices.
So if they took that as a one-time cost and didn't really change very much in the end, how well are global value chains functioning now?
Well, now the situation has changed substantially. And I think that the war has served as a trigger here. It actually forced firms to take concrete actions to boost resilience of their supply chains. This did not happen because of direct disruptions associated with the war. After all, Russia and Belarus were not very integrated in global supply chains. But rather, the war brought about a realization that the geopolitical shocks are not going away anytime soon.
So, if there is this reorganization, who's going to benefit from that?
So, for instance, a representative survey of 4,000 German firms showed that firms have taken concrete actions to improve resilience of their supply chains. Two-thirds of them have added additional suppliers. Two-thirds have increased inventories. So we are seeing diversification of the supply base, and we are seeing a movement from a just-in-time approach to a just-in-case approach. Not surprisingly, larger firms are adjusting according to the former margin, while smaller firms prefer to an adjustment via inventories. This process is likely to continue because half of German firms expressed intention to further diversify their supply base.
Well, this is a huge change, isn't it? And so on one side of it, someone must be benefiting. Who is?
In the case of European supply chains, I think that emerging Europe is likely to benefit. So we are talking here about the Eastern European EU member states, Western Balkans, but also Turkey and North Africa stand to benefit. Now, this will not happen immediately because we are still in an environment of high energy costs in Europe. And of course, the proximity to the war will dampen appetite for investment. But over the medium term, I would expect these countries to benefit.
On the other side of the ledger, those global value chains were set up to minimize costs for example, those German firms that you were talking about. If these changes now, they must be costly for them. Do they act as a sort of a tax on doing business?
Well, this is the insurance cost rather than a tax of doing business.
Yeah.
Resilience is valuable and does not come for free. But there is another implication of these changes. They matter for central banks. Over the past few decades, international trade served as a force that was bringing down inflationary pressures. Now, international trade may actually contribute to inflation. Now, this impact is going to be limited and spread over a few years, but nevertheless, it's likely to be there.
In 2019, Kevin O'Rourke spoke to Vox Talks about whether current events really signal, as we call it, the end of globalization. And in October 2021, Maurice Obstfeld spoke to us about another controversial aspect of 21st century capitalism in the episode Rethinking Financial Globalization.
Let's have a look at one of those changes in particular that you have just published a paper about.
I would see that involving friendshoring, that we have a group of partners we feel comfortable with. We're not worried about geopolitical issues. We know that we can count on them. We get the benefits of continued efficiencies in production by having a group of partners who work to shore up supply chains and make them more resilient.
Right, so this term, friend shoring, this new trade jargon term, it was being used regularly by a lot of people, particularly in the US in 2022. So you heard distinctively Janet Yellen there in the audio. What does friend shoring actually mean? How is it different from sort of nearshoring or onshoring?
Typically, friendshoring is understood as trading mostly with countries that share the same values. That is, countries that believe in multi-party democracy, freedom of expression. It is viewed as a way of protecting one country from other countries trying to weaponize trade.
And Is it something that we could seriously describe as policy for a country like the US yet, or is it just something that's talked about in speeches at the moment?
Well, friendshoring is not a policy, or at least not yet. It is more of a principle that is guiding a whole range of policies. It is a trend towards making trade more restrictive towards countries that are perceived as not being friendly. The US-China trade war and the US CHIPS Act are cases in point.
We've been talking a lot so far about the costs of changing your supply chain, and this is something that you've done in this paper, trying to find out the price of friendshoring. I guess, first of all, if you're going to do that, we have to have some rigorous definition of friends. It always seems quite vague in these speeches and statements. So how did you interpret friends, and how can you model that interpretation?
Well, in our simple what if exercise, we assume that the world would split into two blocks along the lines of the UN vote on the resolution condemning Russian aggression against Ukraine.
Right.
141 countries at that time voted in favor, and in our exercise, they would constitute one block, while everyone else would end up being in the second block. And then we assumed that the trade costs between these two blocks would go up by about 20%.
Mm-hmm. And are you doing this analysis to model the impact on your region, the countries in your region?
Yes, we were in particular focusing on the EBRD countries of operations, simply because this analysis was done as a background paper for our transition report.
So what does it cost for friendshoring to work, to achieve its stated goals?
Using friendshoring as an insurance policy comes at a high welfare cost. Under the scenario that I have described, essentially every country suffers a welfare loss. And I think there is a message here to policymakers that they shouldn't take friendshoring very lightly.
Yes, before we were discussing winners and losers. Are you saying with friendshoring in particular, there are only losers?
Pretty much so. And in our analysis, focusing on our countries of operations, Kazakhstan and Morocco are the biggest losers. They are both in the bloc that declined to condemn the invasion of Ukraine, but they also have strong links with economies in both blocs. So that means that the trade is affected very strongly.
All of these changes are economically significant. Do you think that, especially with friendshoring, policymakers and firms are underestimating the economic cost?
I doubt it. I actually think that policymakers understand the cost, but they are simply willing to bear them to achieve their geopolitical goals.
They achieve their geopolitical goals, but looking at economic growth around the world, are these changes to global value chains, which the global value chains themselves did so much to boost growth during the era of globalization, putting that into reverse?
I fear so. And I fear that friendshoring will have long-term consequences. And I fear that once wheels are set in motion to reverse globalization, it's going to be very difficult to change this trend.
Well, that's a warning. You friendshore at your peril, Beata. Thank you very much for talking to me about it.
Thank you, Tim.
The paper on friendshoring is called Economic Costs of Friendshoring, and the authors are Beata, Lucas Kitzmuller, Helena Schweiger, and Mohamed Yildirim. It is discussion paper 17764 at CEPR. And if you want to read more, then we were discussing intermediated trade, and the reference for that is Chipulkin, Yavorchik, and Plekhanov. That is an EBRD working paper called The Eurasian Roundabout, Sanctions and Trade Flows into Russia Through the Caucasus and Central Asia. And if you want to get a big picture analysis of what's happening in global trade at the minute, don't forget that the EBRD's transition report 2022-23, called Business Unusual, chapter 3 of the report is all about what's happening in supply chains at the moment.
This has been a Vox Talk from the Center for Economic Policy Research. We bring you the best new research in economics every week, so subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you're hearing, why not leave a review?